Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode CXXII, Q&AV.
How many letters can you get together there?
Shh, I'm doing my intro.
Okay.
In which you ask the questions and mostly Rhiannon will answer them. Hi, Rhiannon.
Hello.
I don't often do those live, do I?
No, I know. I don't get to drop comments in and make fun of it.
Yeah, and and correct me, because you need another space to correct me in. And this is essentially, if you've seen Wallace and Gromit, this is Gromit laying down the train tracks as he's running over them, which I think might have happened in the wrong trousers.
Right.
I'll send you a GIF. It basically just means, you know, I'm recording and putting the podcast out really quickly, which is why I just did my intro.
I see.
Yeah, I'll send you a GIF. All right, so let's open with a question from Graham London. Did the average Roman still use the consulship to mark each year once the role of the consuls became less important during the imperial period? So would it have been the sixth year of the reign of Septimius Severus, for example?
It is partly that. And say on official buildings or, you know, inscriptions we've got, that is what gets put up there. I mean, they're paid for by the emperor, aren't they?
Mm.
So it's, the fourth year of his tribunician power or his sixth consulship, whatever.
Yeah.
So yes, in official contexts, the precise roles of the emperor and the number of times he's done it are going to be more significant and more visible.
Mm.
There are quite a few things to unpack in this question, though. It's a really good question. The average Roman, really hard for us to know always.
Yeah.
But what we do know is at least elite senatorial Romans still regarded it as really important to be consul, to the extent that the emperor actually awarded more than one round of consulships a year. And pretty soon, you've got a consulship a month.
Yeah, I remember Septimius Severus just making a complete mockery of the system, essentially, going, you're a consul, you're a consul, you're a consul.
Yeah, so that more and more people can be recognised. During the Republic, it had always been incredibly competitive.
Mm.
And even though, from our point of view, I guess, in democracies, 1 year for a magistracy doesn't seem that long, there's still too many men wanting to get to that role. So it's quite cutthroat. A lot of people who want it will never get it. But in the imperial period, given that it means less, why not give the honour away to more people?
Yes.
They still want that honour. They want to have that acknowledgement. And each year there are two sort of premier consuls, as it were, who will lend their name to the year. All right. So they get that acknowledgement. So it's a question that's quite right in the sentiment that the consulship becomes less important. But the Romans sort of recognize that in both the doling out of it more, because of course that reduces the currency of it, and in trying to put that right by having at least two of them get a bit more recognition and still be the consuls of the year.
Yeah, yeah. So in the case of keeping track of years, though, it very quickly goes to, I guess it would have happened during the reign of Augustus. This is the 17th year of the reign of Augustus.
They don't talk about it as reigns. They're still talking in terms of the consulships of Augustus.
Yeah.
So, you know, he'll talk about in my third consulship I did.
Oh, and, right. And, you know, doing it,
we have that whole inscription that is his epitaph, the res gestae. And it's interesting that he starts to count the years of in my third consulship. And that is a big switch.
That's Augustus, though. He was trying to have his cake and eat it too.
They are sort of doing it both ways. Mm. They can potentially say in the year of the consulship of. But I have to admit, I hadn't really given this an awful lot of thought before, but Augustus is really changing things if you read the res gestae in the way he refers to years. And that starts to happen on coinage as well and in official inscriptions. So the emperor is clearly having a lot more recognition in terms of date than the consuls.
All right. Thanks for that question, Graham. We'll just go on with Chris McDonald from somewhere in Australia, because he asks something else that is Augustus, so let's just tangent slide into that. When Livia, this is a nice little technicality, when Livia was adopted into the Julian family in Augustus's will, did she posthumously become his daughter?
Yeah, okay, making it look incestuous that she'd been married to him all those years. Yeah, technically she did.
Yeah.
She was adopted into the family. She became Julia Augusta, so she's not Livia anymore. And that is, of course, the name that she would have had if she'd been adopted into any family. We're much more familiar with seeing men adopted. So we know that when Augustus was adopted, he gets all of Julius Caesar's name and he can add Octavianus at the end of it. And so, yeah, that's how she becomes one of his heirs. That's how she gets that title. And it's really important for her authority that she gets the title Augusta. Technically, she is now his daughter, but really it was a way of giving her more honor upon his death to kind of maintain her position.
Okay. Thanks for that question, Chris. We'll go to Julie Britton from Canada. She's asking about here Roman clothing and fabric. So we know a lot about the clothes Romans wore. I'd like to know about the various fabrics. Upper class women, I think, famously were supposed to be busy weaving. But what was the fabric? Goat or sheep wool or both? Did they use linen or cotton, and where did it grow?
Okay, so we know they used linen. We know that they had flax, and they actually called it linum. We think they probably were able to import cotton. I can't answer the question about goat or sheep wool. They just talk about wool. I don't know if that's ever made absolutely specific. But of course, we do know that wool was used for the togas, usually. As I say, we know a lot of linen was imported, in particular from Egypt. So having that empire meant they had access to all of that. If you're really interested in pursuing more of that on this, there is a great book called Greek and Roman Textiles and Dress, an interdisciplinary anthology by Mary Harlow and Mary Louise Nosh, which will go into a lot more detail there. But yeah, they had access to these materials. Presumably linen would have been quite expensive because largely imported, but much lighter and much more suitable for their climate. I don't know why they were using wool. I would have avoided it.
Well, you got to use what you have on hand, I suppose. Thanks for that question, Julie. This question now I've got is from Edu Rodriguez from Wellington, Ontario. Shout out to Wellington. Do you guys know anything about the Cantabrian warrior Coracotta? In my region, he was alleged to have shown up in the emperor's court claiming his reward for having caught himself. Apparently, Augustus was so impressed by his audacity, he offered him not only the promised reward, but also a job in the Roman army. So what do we know about this? I gather this from a text.
This warrior does turn up in one of our historians. He turns up in Dio.
Only in Dio?
Cassius Dio.
Yeah. So a couple of hundred years later.
Yeah. I mean, he's not there in Suetonius, but then Suetonius is a biographer, not a historian. Tacitus doesn't cover this period. So, you know, the fact that it doesn't occur anywhere else doesn't necessarily mean that none of it's true.
All right. Not putting too much water on it then.
But, no.
Okay.
But if anyone wants to go look, and of course this is available online on Lacus Curtius, it's in book 56 of Dio's history at chapter 43. This is explaining Augustus's moods, so that sometimes Augustus got angry with people who'd injured him. Sometimes he forgave or kept faith, it says here, with those who didn't deserve it. And then this is all the information in Dio. It's very brief. I can read it all out. For instance, there was a robber named Coracotta who flourished in Spain, at whom he, that's Augustus, was so angry at first that he offered 1,000,000 sesterces to the man that should capture him alive. But later, when the robber came to him of his own accord, so that bit is from Dio, not only did him no harm, but actually made him richer by the amount of the reward. So he gave him 1,000,000 sesterces.
Doesn't say anything about a job,
but
did get the reward.
Yeah. So it's not all fantasy. There is some truth to it. He is called a robber rather than a warrior in Dio's account.
Some truth to it, enough for a local folk hero.
Yeah.
Statue.
Yeah, and I've looked at some of the commentary on this, and ancient historians sort of debate whether he was a bandit or a resistance leader.
Sure.
Which I guess are two sides of the same coins in some places. It's very hard to tell on the basis of minimal evidence.
Thank you for that question, Edu, and I hope your folk hero is still intact. Next question is from rival Roman history podcaster.
Oh, don't say rival. fellow history.
Cameron Riley, Brisbane, Queensland. Just started watching HBO's Rome again. Great show. And happy to hear them pronounce it Pompeii, not Pompeii. And remembering all the flack that he got when in the early episodes of his podcast, people told him he was pronouncing it wrong.
I'm really torn on this. I mean, most of us say Pompey. It's true. It's an anglicized version. And look, it's an E-I. It should be A.
Yeah.
But I guess if we're going to say his name, it should be Pompeius. And I have heard some people call him Pompeius. We're changing his name slightly, whether we do Pompey or Pompey.
Okay.
I call him Pompey, but I realize it's just convention. And we don't have to stick with convention, as long as we're clear about what we're talking about. And I suppose the reason it's become convention is to separate it out from the place name.
Sure,
you know, as I think we've talked before about the fact that there was confusion when they began to excavate Pompeii.
They found an inscription in the area.
And thought it referred to Pompeius.
Which said Pompeii, and they've gone, oh, look, Pompey had a house in the area. Yeah. And there was much confusion. But I suppose it also comes down to, as you say, it's an English language version of his name anyway, exactly the same as we do for Mark Antony.
And Caesar.
And Cicero. So
we're mangling them all, I'm afraid.
Yeah, but if we're going to be consistent.
I don't know. Is he pronouncing it Kaiser and Antonius?
But wait, that means HBO's Rome has it wrong if they're calling him Pompey.
Only as wrong as Pompey.
Sure. Okay.
That's what I'm saying. None of us has it right.
Hope that clears it up, Cameron.
No, I think we've just added to the mess. Sorry.
We'll have an audio question now. This is from Ethan McBride in Toronto, Canada.
Hi, Matt and Rhiannon. My name's Ethan from Toronto, Canada. I just want to know the main difference between a patrician and a plebeian. I know about the time of Julius Caesar, the differences were negligible, but did the status officially just disappear by the time of the mid-empire? Thanks. Love the podcast.
Okay, so this is a good question. It's not always easy for us to tell. So the difference comes from very early Rome, and it's one of status. Patrician is a very small upper class. The word is related to the word that means father, pater, and these are the fathers, and patres is another name for the senators. So there's almost certainly overlap between who are senators and who are patrician families. And if you're in a patrician family, those families continue. Then you have a certain amount of authority, status. Initially, you know, only patricians can be consuls, but the plebeians start to whittle away at those positions. And in the mid-republic, this is happening in particular. There's what we call the clash of the orders. Mm-hmm. That's the orders of patrician and plebeian. And they start to get things like, very importantly, they get their own tribunes, the tribunes of the plebs. That's what gives them a lot more power. And then there's a law that at least one of the consuls has to be a plebeian. So they just start to sort of chip away at those powers and positions that only patricians could have initially.
Yes.
So all that said, Ethan is quite right that by the time of Caesar, there's no difference in what positions you can hold, except for the tribunes of the plebs can only be held by a plebeian. That doesn't mean it's meaningless, though. Caesar's family is a patrician family. They don't have much money, but he can really make some use of that patrician background. He can talk about things his ancestors have done, you know, places they have held in Roman society. He makes a lot of hay out of his family, and Augustus does too when he's adopted into it.
Mm.
So it's not meaningless, but it's kind of authority rather than real power. I suspect that that got less and less and less the further we got into the empire, because everything is changing under the emperors, and all terms of power and authority are only important in relation to the imperial family. So by the time we get to post-Nero, it's not even a senatorial family. The Flavians are an equestrian family.
Basically, you get to the point where the ranks of society mean so little that you get somebody like Maximinus Thrax becoming an emperor. And so he was the first emperor who wasn't from the senatorial class or the equestrian class. Any self-made man, I suppose, can reach for the highest level. In a similar vein, we've got a question here from Claude J. Lemelin from Gatineau in Quebec, Canada. We speak very often of the senatorial class and the equestrian class. Were there others? Where did the class system come from? Why did they exist?
And I'm sure I have used the word class, but a lot of ancient historians would really have a problem with that because it makes it sound like working class and middle class and upper class.
Yeah, and it's very hard not to draw those kind of parallels, isn't it?
Yeah, so a lot of books will use the word order, the equestrian order, the senatorial order, and that comes from the Latin word ordo, which means rank. So it might be splitting hairs. No, there weren't really others. I mean, beneath that, you have free people who will have different amounts of property. And property is what counts, particularly in early Rome. It gives you more power, makes your vote more powerful as a Roman citizen. All right. You don't all have equal access to power. You all get to vote, but your vote, it means a different thing depending on how much property you've got. And I guess you could say there are different ranks within the army, and all early Roman ranks relate to the army. So the equestrian class initially supposedly comes from, I see I've used the word class there as well. The equestrian order comes from the people who could afford to keep a horse and use that horse in warfare.
So this is why he had equestrian knights. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not that at all by the time we have any records that matter.
Yes.
It's become a property class. So how much property you have puts you into that order. And the same for the senators, you know, initially 1 million sesterces and then it's raised to 4 million sesterces to even potentially be a senator. Beneath that, you pretty much have free-born and slave and then freed slave.
Okay.
They are the classes, as it were. Slaves at the bottom.
Yeah.
Freed slaves above them.
Mm.
They technically have a form of Roman citizenship.
Yeah.
Above them, free-born.
Sure.
But then amongst the freeborn, a whole spectrum depending on how much property you have. We don't tend to give it specific words, but they will have belonged to different groups when they got to vote, at least the men, on that basis.
Okay. Thanks for that question, Claude. Next question we've got is from, we'll go with this one, from Soren Crarup.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about the Roman salute, famously popularized by Jacques-Louis David's painting Oath of the Horati? And later used by various right-wing movements, notably the German Nazis. I'd be curious to know how it was actually used in antiquity.
We have no information that the Romans used a salute anything like the...
At all?
No.
Yeah, why would they actually? They'd just be the Romans saluted the commander.
Yeah, and certainly we don't have any material evidence of the exact same salute where the hand is sort of straight from the wrist and up. All right, so what we do have, if you go look at, and every single documentary you've ever seen about the Roman army or about ancient Rome probably has bits of this in it, Column of Trajan.
I'm about to say Column of Trajan. Yeah,
so the Roman army and basically leaders when they stand in front of crowds generally, but, you know, they're often addressing the troops. So the emperor or the general will often be portrayed kind of raising his hand. But it's more a gesture of pointing towards them almost. The hand is not flipped over in that way.
Mm.
It's what we call the adlocatio, which means addressing the troops. It's the similar posture that you might see if you see the statue of Augustus called the Prima Porta statue.
Mm-hmm.
It's the raised arm, but it's not exactly the same salute. I presume the fascists adapted it, but it's not the same. And of course, David was kind of obsessed with using Roman myth and Roman accounts to portray the kind of characteristics he wanted to see in people in the French Revolution. And the Oath of the Horati is based on a Roman legend where these three sets of triplets, we should do some Roman myth because it's crazy. Three sets of triplets do triple combat against each other. The Horati are the Roman ones. There is nothing in any of our accounts about an oath. He made this up.
Okay.
And he painted it, but it's very famous because of his painting.
Mm. All right. Thanks for that question there, Soren. Let's move on to Toby. How closely related is Latin to ancient Greek? I've heard the Romans adopted much of Greek culture, but what about language? Did the language change much over Roman history? So did later Romans find older language different, similar to how Shakespearean English is difficult to understand by us today? So
we don't find it hard, do we, Matt? We talk like that all the time.
So if I was if I was a Roman in the later empire and I sat down with my Livy because my history teacher assigned it for homework, would I be going, oh, not Livy, and having to interpret what that Latin is compared to the Latin that I'm speaking?
It won't have been the way they spoke by then, but it was probably never the way people spoke entirely because it's very rhetorical and all Roman writing is. And look, this is part of our problem with the Latin we've got. It's all very literary or rhetorical or both. And from what we can tell from things like graffiti, maybe occasionally Suetonius tells us some saying that's going around.
Yeah.
Of course, they're speaking colloquially quite different. And that is why eventually Latin will become French and Italian because it moves on.
Yes.
So, yes, there was probably a difference. Literary Latin kind of fossilizes. It seems to have been taught so consistently that I think that was the form of Latin that they learnt and how they generally learnt to write. So these rhetorical skills continued to be learnt. So I don't think it's quite like us reading Shakespeare or Chaucer.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say I'm not an expert on that later period, and others might have a different view on that.
How about the Greek influence of things?
Yeah, look, that's an interesting question. Latin was a highly developed language by the time the Romans and those the others speaking Latin become immersed in Greek. But of course, they do have a lot of respect for Greek literature. It doesn't have quite as much influence over Latin itself as it has over the genres they write in and the way that their poetry develops and things like that. And there are some words that come in, and this probably happened especially in southern Italy, which is much more Greek influenced. This is the easy way to tell. If a word's got a TH or a PH or a CH in it, it comes from Greek. The word theatre, theatrum in Latin, right? That comes from a Greek word to do with looking.
Okay.
So, yeah, there are words that creep in, and then that's happened even more so in later Latin that becomes scientific Latin. Mm. A lot of that is just adapted Greek.
Okay, thanks for that question, Toby. So the next question we've got is another audio question. This is from Alan Jones in Wales.
Hello, Matt. Hello, Rhiannon. This is Alan Jones from Wales. My question is to Rhiannon, and it's about Roman numerals. Well, you, Matt, you introduce each podcast with its respective number in the series set out as Roman numerals using the English names for the letters. But what would they have called their numbers in Latin, and how would they have conveyed their counting system? Thanks.
So, Rhiannon, this is episode CXXXII. How would the Romans have said episode 132 of Emperors of Rome podcast?
All right. So I wanted to answer this question because it's an interesting question, but also because Alan is the only person I've heard pronounce my name properly in years. But thank you for that, Alan. The Romans used those numbers that we're used to, the I's and the V's and so on, in all official usage, because it's much, much shorter than saying the number out. So on inscriptions, it's no coincidence that they're straight lines. The Romans like to inscribe things, so they use them a lot. But they do have names for them. We hardly ever use them. I mean, in texts, they will just use the Roman numeral. So if it's something like 132, then they're probably going to use
CXXXII.
But if we wanted to say that in Latin, that you kind of build them up.
Yeah.
So it's centum is 100.
Yeah.
And then 30 is triginta.
Yeah.
And 2 is duo.
All right. So exactly the same. We build it up as well. Yeah. 132.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they do have words for those numbers, and they also have adjectives. So you can say the hundredth. For example, the word that gives us prime is primus, which means the first.
Yeah.
So they have those what we call cardinal and ordinal numbers. And presumably they did use them in everyday speech, but we don't have recordings. How did they count is a big question, because their system of numbering doesn't lend itself to easy arithmetic in the way that the Arabic numerals that we use does. Mm. So it must have been much more cumbersome. And of course, they had abacuses and such like.
Yeah.
But it was much more difficult. I mean, doing long division with Roman numerals, it's not going to work.
And I also know that from graffiti in Pompeii and those sort of things, that they weren't always consistent as well. So we say that the Roman numerals for 4 is IV and 5 is V, but they would just keep counting with ones.
Exactly. What they did informally is not necessarily what we learn.
All right. Thanks for that question, Alan. Last question that we've got here is from Tyler Curtis from Washington, Pennsylvania. Who do you think was an important person in Roman history that isn't widely recognized because of a lack of information on them? Which is a good question. So I had two thoughts when it came to this, and they were both emperors because, of course, we'd want to know more about emperors. One is Trajan. Who we don't have
that is a good point.
A lot of sources on. We just make up things around the edges, don't we?
Well, I mean, we have letters.
We've got letters that he wrote to Pliny, but, you know, that's mostly just saying, you know, Pliny, handle it. We don't have a biography. We skip over it. The other one that I'd like to know more about is Antoninus Pius, because I think we've got quite a lot on Hadrian, or we can join a lot of dots on Hadrian. Antoninus Pius, emperor for 20 years, had such an effect on the Roman Empire that emperors for the next 100 years keep his name alive, right up until, you know, 238
Yeah, and I mean, we sort of incorrectly call that dynasty the Antonine Dynasty sometimes, yeah. Don't we? The emperors, as it were.
So we attribute quite a lot to that guy. And yet, I remember when we did this in the Emperors of Rome, when we covered him, we did one episode on him because we don't have anything really to say for that 20-year period. You know, there's no sources to... There'd be a lot of interesting stuff to find out about his reign. So there you go.
I'd like to know more about Roman women in general.
Mm.
But maybe, I think specifically, there's so many of them that you sort of get dropped in as names, and then the only accounts we have are from the point of view of men, or maybe it's just the odd line. But I'm thinking that I would like to know more about Fulvia.
Yeah.
Mark Antony's wife. Partly because she was involved in a war, in the Perusine War. How many Roman women can you say that about? And yet the amount of information is sort of perilously thin.
Mm.
But also, I guess, more about, for example, that Vindolanda letter that we've talked about before.
You wanted to know how that party went off?
Invitation, yeah. I want to know more about the life of Claudia Severa, say, who was involved in that invitation. One other person. Sorry, you only asked for one, but I'm going to give you a whole lot.
I gave you two.
I'd like to know more about Antinous, partly because I've got a student who's working on Antinous at the moment, who's usually known euphemistically as the boy love of Hadrian.
Hadrian's Antinous, yes.
Yeah. And, you know, we've got a whole heap of statues of Antinous in many different guises. Antinous as Apollo, Antinous as a pharaoh. Mm. They're all post-mortem. He drowned in the Nile. Everything we know, as in so many other tangential characters to our main narrative, is in relation to Hadrian.
Mm.
I'd like to know more about his life and where he comes from. And my student would really love to know.
Thanks for that question, Tyler. You've been listening to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. You can subscribe to this podcast in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review. As always, they are very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I am at Nightlight Guy. This is the last episode of Emperors of Rome for MMXIX. So until the new year, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.